Even Simon Peter raised his sword to defend our Lord. Rudy didn't want paying himself. He was doing it out of respect for your old man. Your father had given him a little money as wages for the men, but he didn't take any. He was very particular that I know that. It was never meant to go as far as it did. Things got out of hand. That's the tragedy. Rudy said your father couldn't live with it, and the remorse killed him. Rudy said he never felt anything but admiration for you, and he was sorry how it had changed you. He said you kind of went into yourself after it happened. You were always so outgoing, couldn't keep still, always moving like a ball in a bagatelle. You had big dreams, I remember. Move out east, back to the States. You never had the spirit of a small-town girl. He said there was a time when there was just a handful of you all living in the rubble of Evangeline like refugees. He said he'd see you every day, circling the place on horseback like a wraith. Depressed the hell out of him to see what had become of you. I remember how you were too, Makepeace, bright as a button. You were a pretty thing, too. A lot of us were sweet on Makepeace Hatfield. I understand why you lied to me about the zone. But we're not enemies. Look at me. Time hasn't been kind to me. By two hops and you can be out of here. Take us to where the flasks are and we can ride that plane to Barrow. People live very well there. It's like it was here in the old days. Very neighborly, very respectful. And bit by bit we're building something we can leave our children. Not all fathers are like yours, Makepeace. He stood up and took something out of his pocket. I brought you dessert, he said. I'm sorry if what I said has hurt you, but I thought it was better for you to know. He called to the guard to see him out of the room. There was a step down to manage on the way out, and he wobbled somewhat as he took it. But aside from that, you would never guess his eyes had gone. The guard loosened my hands. I thought at first he'd left me behind an apple, but I soon knew what it was. The first I'd ever seen. An orange. I scraped the skin with my nail and it let out a smell that seemed to have flowers and mint and burnt sugar in it. After a moment I could smell sea spray, too. But I couldn't bring myself to eat the thing. There was an electrical storm that night, as big as any I can remember. It kicked off with a drum roll of thunder way out to the east of us, toward the coast, toward Evangeline. Then the sky darkened and flashed, throwing down chunks of ice so big that I thought we were under attack. There was an electrical storm that night, as big as any I can remember. It kicked off with a drum roll of thunder way out to the east of us, toward the coast, toward Evangeline. Then the sky darkened and flashed, throwing down chunks of ice so big that I thought we were under attack. It pounded the yard and rustled the trees and slammed the tin roofs of the prisoners' barracks. All my life I spent with people whose whole task on earth was bound up with acting rightly, and I guess I got the habit of it. Now I had found myself standing in a world where the right had perished. I had always believed that right was like north to my father, a thing as real as sunlight, a place on the map, the arrow on the compass. It was the unalterable facts of duty, love, and conscience. But our world had gone so far north that the compass could make no sense of it, could only spin hopelessly in its binnacle. North had melted right off the map. North was every which way. North was nowhere. For so long, the plain had been my north, and in a strange way so had Eben Callard. I was anchored by the bad thing just as by the hope that in a distant city some semblance of order, of right, was giving meaning to my world. But we were long past that place. I stood in the dark, trying to make sense of a room that was lit by flashes of light through a keyhole. An hour or two past midnight, the hailstorm ceased, and the air grew quiet and fresh. I rattled on the door with my tin cup to get the guard. Then I told him I had a message for Eben Callard. Chapter 7. It took them another day and a half to distill ethanol for the plane's spare tank. The plan was to take enough for two flights and miss out the base on the journey back. They let me back to sleep in my old room, and I was up at dawn waiting by the plane in the caramel morning light as the horses were loaded up a ramp at the back. The animals balked at the stink of oil and spirit, but the guards shoved them in and fixed them in slings to hold them through the journey. I know in the old days that even the Tungus flew sometimes, and they moved their prize caribou by air. Then we took our places among them, some of us on boxes, others on the seats that swung down from worn latchings on each side of the plane. The inside was painted sky blue with Russian words stenciled on it. I felt for all the world that I was in a shed. It didn't seem possible that it would ever be able to leave the ground. We sat there for almost an hour before the props started turning, so I had plenty of time to think about what I had chosen. I felt that Shamsuddin would have approved of the deal I'd struck. Civilization and cities are the same thing, he'd said. I wished he was coming with me. I wasn't too old for change. Eben was the last to get in. He was helped up to a seat beside the pilot in the front of the plane and put on some headgear to talk to him with. At the takeoff, we rumbled across the grass outside the base so slowly I couldn't see how we'd lift before we hit the trees. Then, just when it seemed the pilot had misjudged the takeoff, the note of the engine changed and she rose up, and an invisible weight pressed me into my seat. The horses seemed more calm about the notion of flying than I was. They swayed a little as we lifted, but never stopped munching out of their feed bags. I had to turn awkwardly to look through the windows. I could see the ground dropping away beneath us as we turned in a wide arc over the base. It was spread out beneath us like a toy fort. The men who were marching out to work all turned as one to look up. The bare ground around them was brown and faded like a worn bearskin. Summer and winter are the two moods of the North, but so different that you'd take them for different places. And then we were over the taiga, one green vastness all the way to the horizon, here and there slashed with little rills of white water. The size of it made my neck prickle. At its distant edges I could make out the faint curve of the globe. There was a roar in the cabin that was too loud to speak over, and some of the men dozed. The ones beside me were jumpy during the flight. They watched me carefully, not quite believing I would be helping them willingly. It wouldn't have been hard to grab hold of the steering and plunge all of us into the trees, but I was as good as my word. It took us half a day to cover the same distance it had taken weeks to ride. Toward noon, we got a signal from the cabin that we were passing over the zone. You had to see Pauline from the air to understand what a masterpiece it was. It lay bleaching in the sun underneath us like the bits of a broken machine, streets fanning out from the hub of the main square, the river alongside it like a sheet of hammered lead reflecting the sun back up at us with a dull glow, and that big head, no more than a bronze pimple. The pilot brought us down on a stretch of flat ground by the riverside. We seemed to speed up as we landed until the trees were rushing past us, and it felt like we would certainly crash, but the plane bounced a couple of times like a skimmed stone, and then pulled up to a stop. The sunlight was fierce as I climbed out. The props died gradually into silence, until all you could hear was the boisterous sound of the insects. The mosquitoes plagued us from the moment we touched down. We wore head nets to fend them off, but any bare skin they'd settle on in a moment and gorge there until you killed them or until they flew off, fat and giddy with blood. It took a while to unpack the plane. The horses had to come down the ramp again, and they took some cajoling. The men smoked constantly, and they bickered and shouted, nervous about the place we were in. We made camp a good way from the bridge, because the pile of bodies was stinking. It was a lot different from my last time there. They'd brought bedding, fresh food, and clean firewood from the base, not to keep warm, but for smoke to put off the insects. The pilot slept in the plane that night, but the rest of them spent the night in the open, sleeping in shifts, so there was always someone keeping one eye on the Tungus and another on me. They still didn't trust my change of heart. Apafagado had told me I should shave my hair off as a safeguard, anything to stop dust leaving the zone. So at first light I snipped it short with some clippers and finished it off with a razor. The guards were asleep. Eben Callard had a private tent and two men to guard it. Like he'd said, he had to be careful how he did business. I had some tools but no weapons to speak of, and I knew there was nothing I could do to stop the double cross. I just hoped if they'd decided to kill me, they'd do it quickly. My hair lay all around me in mousy tufts. It was darker than I'd expected, but for the first time in my life, I could see there was gray in it. I stroked my naked skull with my fingers. It felt queer and slick to the touch. It was a comfort to cradle it somehow. It was warm and there was a pulse in it. It reminded me of Ping. The last thing I did was to throw away the keepsake I had made from the wing. I'd been wearing it so long it left a smudge of gray on my skin. I took it off and pitched it into the river. It rose and dipped like a bird in flight, then vanished. I thought that whatever hopes and convictions she had cherished, Makepeace was just another mask that life wore as it fought to renew itself. Unsentimental, unsparing, fighting ugly. I didn't doubt that Eben had told me the truth. Bill Evans had a rule of thumb he used to size up suspects. It wasn't foolproof, what is, but it helped to get a handle on people. He called it the law of opposites. He said the truth of a man is the opposite of what he wants you to know about him. If you want to understand someone, you have to find a way to catch hold of his shadow. By Bill's reckoning, the man to fear is the one always harping on about goodness. My father felt exalted by the thought of the things he had given up to live his life. He believed that he was a better man than those people who had clung on to riches and city life, who had been slower to see the changes in the world. But the truth was, he wasn't even as good a man as Eben Callard. Eben was cruel and blunt and practical. He called himself a Christian, but his real beliefs put him closer to the Tungus. There was no right in the first religions, no goodness to confuse the shamans, just the way things were done, just what served life and what didn't, and no room for hypocrisy. The prayers my father had offered were the prayers of the Pharisee. He spoke of God and sacrifice. But his God was his own vanity, and the sacrifice had turned out to be me. I crossed back into the zone a few hours after dawn. The town was quite different with spring on it. The chestnut trees were in flower on the main streets, and the sidewalks seemed coated with a kind of sticky sap that had been thrown down from some of the branches. But in general, there was something sicklier and deader about Pauline in the summer. In winter it had seemed frozen, or maybe asleep like the princess in the fairy tale. But in summer, you could see she wasn't just dead. Her corpse was fly-blown. It took me till early afternoon to find the place Shamsuddin had told me about, and I spent another hour fixing holds to the wall with the tools I'd brought with me. I tied a rope to one of them. Then I squeezed myself through the broken window and dropped down into the basement. It wasn't exactly how Shamsuddin had described it. The way he had told it, the storeroom was near the place he'd come in, but there was nothing like that nearby. The chamber was much bigger than I'd expected. It was a walkway almost the size of a road that was lit with hidden skylights and ways coming off it every 10 yards or so. It was a labyrinth, all right, but on the white tiles of the floor I could see traces of dirt and dried blood where Shamsuddin had been before me, so I let him lead me down. Following his prints was like tracking a wounded thing. The way they doubled back on themselves, went nowhere in particular, and seemed to rest exhausted in one place before continuing. They still told of his despair. The man who left these marks had only days to live, I thought. And as I followed him deeper into the labyrinth, I wondered how long I had. And I thought about the double cross. I figured it was 50-50 that they'd shoot me on the bridge. The storeroom was much deeper than he'd explained, down several ramps and staircases that he'd never mentioned. I doubt anyone else could have found it. Only someone who'd lost all hope of getting out by another way would have floundered this deeply into the building. Out of all the combinations of turns and corridors, he happened on this one. There was almost a divinity in that, until you remembered how he ended. Deep, deep inside the bowels of that thing, I found a bloody handprint head high on a pair of double doors, and beyond those, the storeroom. It was filled with rack upon rack of jars filled with their flickering blue essence. They looked identical at first, but when you examined them more closely, you saw tiny variations in shape and design, until I wasn't sure if they were even two the same. I've been in some strange places in my life, but there was something about that room that was so unforeseen. It felt stranger than a tomb, like something divine but in a religion unknown to me. I thought of the shaman dropping in on the bones of his ancestors. At that moment, if you'd told me that each one of those jars contained a human soul, I might have believed you. I wasn't minded to hang around in there. I put 4 in my bag and lit out. The prisoners at the base used to joke about overfulfilling the plan. They said it when some newcomer to their team worked too hard and seemed likely to make them look bad. The first few times they'd say it as a joke, but if the person kept on digging or threshing as though his life depended on it, usually in the hope of impressing the guards, then there might be a beating, or worse. Once I saw a man have his toes taken off with a shovel. The long-term inmates knew it did you no favors to exceed expectations. I was keen not to overfulfill the plan. There was easily a dozen plane loads down in those stores, but it seemed to me that there would come a point when I'd brought out so much they wouldn't need me anymore. If that happened, I guess they'd cancel my ticket to Barrow. The evening light was melting back into caramel once again by the time I hit the avenue of chestnut trees and bent left onto the bridge. The sound of hooves and laughter echoed from a long way off along the concrete wall of the river, just as the gunshots did the time before. I dismounted at the bridge approach and walked the last stretch to the blockpost. There were only 2 guards waiting. I slung my pack over the concrete division and let the guards spray it off. I hitched the horse and dropped my tools on the city side of the blockpost, just how we agreed. I had an uneaten apple in my pants from my lunch, and I offered it to the horse. She nosed it uncertainly, her nostrils quivering. After a moment, she drew back her lips and bit. Then I started to undress, moving gingerly because of all the biting insects. Pretty soon I was standing there naked, slapping away the mosquitoes from my flesh, waiting for the guards to call me across. Gradually, more men started appearing, to watch. There was no sign of the spare clothes. If they're going to kill me, they'll do it now, I thought. I heard a shout. Eben and Mr. Apofagoro were riding slowly back from the plane toward the bridge. The guards were waiting for a signal from him. Eben rode loose and relaxed, letting the horse be his eyes and choose a path through the broken rubble. "How'd it go?" he yelled. "I made a start," I said. "Only four, but they look like good ones," said the guard with the sack. He held one up in the sunlight. His eyes raked over my bare skin as he waited. Eben pulled a rifle from his saddle. "There's a lot more back in there," I said. "Maybe hundreds of them, but it'll take time to tease them out." My voice sounded thin and fearful. Somehow to die naked in front of them felt like the biggest indignity of all. Eben gestured with a rifle in the direction of my voice. "You'd better kill the horse like we agreed," he said. That was the math of survival. Horses were plentiful. Letting one sicken and infect the rest was a risk not worth taking. They could breed another horse, but another makepiece who knew the lie of the city and where the flasks were hidden would take a lot longer to come by. At least that's what I banked on. I stepped over the division. The guards sprayed me down with carbolic soap and handed me the change of clothes. The soap stung my eyes. I stepped into the pants and boots they'd given me. The boots were too big and my feet swam in them a little, but I was overtaken by a wave of relief so strong I felt like I might weep. The evening light seemed to hold the promise of so much life in it. I wanted to live forever and cherish the beautiful things I'd seen. Pauline from the belly of that plane. The girl in her memory stone. The stillness of Evangeline without a soul in it. Looking up at the night sky crowded with pinpricks of light, I'd sometimes fancied I could see a makepiece on another star, a different me, living her last days surrounded by grandchildren. In Alaska, I would grow old. There would be time for other things. The life I'd missed. The pit of my belly swarmed with a radiant peace. "It seems a pity to shoot the horse," I said. "I was thinking I could use her tomorrow." Eben shrugged. "What does Apofagoro say?" Apofagoro shook his head. "It can develop symptoms within 12 hours. I strongly advise against." "You heard the man." Eben flipped the gun in his hands and offered me its stock. It was a beautiful old repeater with a lever on the underside of its barrel, at least 100 years older than I was, with luminous gray metal and its wood almost the same shade of chestnut as the horse. I complimented him on it. Bill Evans had had one a lot like it. It took the same big shells he had used in his handgun. "It's a Winchester," said Eben. "There's a story behind it that I'll tell you one day." The horse had a white star on her forehead. I sighted the gun on that and then lowered it again. "You might want to dismount in case they startle," I said. Apofagoro swung down out of his saddle onto the dust of the bridge, but Eben stayed put, cocksure as ever. "Don't mind me, Makepeace," he said. "Just get it done. I want the other animals to stay clean." I squeezed the trigger. The gun cracked and kicked my shoulder. Then the horse swayed, drawing up her front foot before she fell to the ground. At the crack of the gun, Eben's horse reared up and then slipped. For an instant, he was fighting to stay on her. The two of them fell together in a blur of bodies, the horse twisting before she hit the ground. I thought at first Eben had broken his leg, but he was back on his feet in a flash. Apafagado gathered the reins and was gentling the horse with his hand when Eben snatched them from him and yanked his crop from the saddle. He lashed at the animal. "You bitch!" he cried, leathering her sides until her eyes rolled. It seemed like a few strokes would satisfy his anger, but his rage seemed to feed on itself, growing more savage, as though it had its roots elsewhere in some ancient cruelty. The pain and the fear of pain made the guts of the horse tremble. He thrashed furiously with an action that was suddenly so familiar I could almost hear the bedstead jingling. There was spit on his lips as they twisted into another curse. "You Jezebel!" He turned to where he knew I was standing. "Give me the gun, makepiece," he panted. "What are you waiting for?" Jezebel. The word crackled through my memory like a splash of acid. A bird called back in the city I had just left, and the eddying water behind him seemed to be still for a second. My feet in the borrowed boots moved awful slow as I stepped to my right to find a clean angle. I heard Bill Evans' voice in my head coaching me to move into a firing position. "Move to your right, lead with your right leg. Never cross over yourself." Two of the guards were still laughing. One had turned away to light a smoke. Eben frowned at me, impatient for the gun. I put two shells in him before he had a chance to raise his eyebrows, and the second of them pitched him clean over the side of the bridge. The current swept him under us in a moment. He seemed to be lying face down in the water. I picked off another guard as he went for his sidearm. The others were slack-jawed with disbelief. Apafagado surrendered his horse to me without a murmur. Chapter 8. I hoped to ride hard like I had the last time, but in the days that followed I got sick like never before. I started to puke on the morning of the next day. I couldn't eat or keep food down. I thought at first it was the sickness we'd all feared, but it wasn't anything I'd picked up in the zone. It was something I'd caught off Shamsuddin, the oldest disease of all. It didn't seem possible that such a hasty intimacy could amount to anything. A month had passed, and I had thought nothing of it. I was getting on in years, and I had never been regular, with the food and hardship we had at the base, and every month I half expected my body to shut up shop. But it was more tenacious than that, like some crazy innkeeper laying out fresh linen each night for guests that never come. I passed across the face of the land as summer came and went. By the time I swung north for the last stretch, there was frost at night and the first green showing of the lights. The last few years of weather had broken up the highway, and in places I had to pick my way slowly or dismount. It didn't matter to me. I was in no hurry. I had plenty to contemplate on my journey back. I'd never known the north so beautiful as it was then. I'd find myself wrapped by the tiniest things, a stripe and a stone, the blue crown on a honeysuckle berry, the one the Russian prisoners called a zhimolist. I saw a tabby cat stalking through the long grass, the wild offspring of some long-dead pet. It fled when it saw me, no memory of a human face. There was a tumble-down house nearby. I crouched in its foundations to pee and found a four-leaf clover. At other times in my life, I'd seen animals or plants that had no business there, but now I seemed to come across them every other day. A parrot once. A flash of bright green the color of pondweed and its unmistakable beak. Another time, a plum tree. And once, I swear, a monkey. its pink face fringed with a tiny lion's mane, chattering its bared teeth at me from a silver birch. I have no idea how they got there, but it took hold in my mind that they were salvaged from a busted ark. I pictured it to myself, split or run aground somewhere, and the animals freed from the wreck, breaking out of crates, a whole menagerie crawling and hopping north, tracing the route of the rivers that flowed to the cold. For the first time in as long as I can think, I knew a kind of contentment. And for once, the world wasn't a thing to fight against. Rain was falling when I reached my city. I was lucky to have the business end of a long summer ahead of me. I worked like a crazy thing to get some food in the ground and a spare room ready. By the time the first snow came, I was too big for the morning ride. In fact, I was in the stable when it happened. I stayed on my feet throughout, clutching on to the tack pegs to keep up and terrifying the horses with my screams. It all went quicker than the first time. Just as I was finally doubling up in pain, out popped a fierce-looking little thing with a shock of black hair and the dark face of a tungus, paddling with its limbs and squalling, and a cry more like a mew than a scream. Chapter 9. The other day I counted the books I've saved. There are 2,075 of them stacked up in the armory, and 177 that I've laid by in the house. I also counted 16 boxes of candles that I've stashed in Carlo's old bedroom. They're packed a gross to a box, and if you keep the wicks trimmed, they burn for just above 2 hours. Each box is 12 days of constant light. There's something more than 6 months' worth of them altogether. Of course, you barely need a light all the months of summer. You can read at midnight in June without one, if you read. It gives me a headache at any time of year. The point about the candles is this. One day soon, I'll have to scavenge more boxes again. I have a good guess where I can find some more for now, but one day there'll be no more to be had. One day the candles will all be gone, and the wicks, and all the jars of spirit I have left. I'll have to make do with blubber lamps like the Chukchi have, or get used to living in the dark. There isn't a life to be had in this city anymore. We're not the last just yet. About a year ago, I saw smoke coming from the chimney of the Velasquez house. It gave me a fright at first, but it turned out to be strangers, a man and a woman with a child of about 5 months old. How they got here, I can't guess, and he wasn't able to tell me. He's Chinese or maybe Korean. She looks part Yakut, part Russian. We don't have dealings with each other, but we nod when we pass. I left some cabbages and tiger balm on their stoop in the fall, and they left some kimchi for me. Last winter was a fierce one, as bad as the ones in my childhood, but I know they lasted it, because at the end of March I saw him dragging a sled of ice blocks back from the lake. I haven't seen her or the child for a while. If things go well for them, maybe they'll hunker down, make a life here, have another child or two. But I don't rate things better than 50-50 for them. That's the way things are. Since I was 15 years old, I've been watching the world I knew go to hell. The only part of it that behaves how it should is the half acre of vegetables in back of my house, and even those have grown fickle as the seasons have altered. Time is narrowing on me. I guess I could still leave here if I wanted. Try heading south again, or maybe find a boat to take me to the States. But I don't expect I will now, knowing what I know. There are so many things that I wish could have turned out different. There is no way back for me in this lifetime. That plane I rode in was the last I ever saw. These years that I've written of were the fall of my life. I'm pushing on into my own winter now. This hasn't changed, Old age is as cold as it ever was. I'm growing old and thin. I've had to cinch my gun belt tighter each year to hold what's left of my hips. I'm frailer, too. But I still ride at dawn each day round the fading circle of what was once this city. And I'm still greedy for whatever's left to me. I can't open my eyes soon enough each day to see you, my darling. The road's been quiet for a long time. The only thing moving on it is dust devils in the summer months. Sometimes I look at it and wonder, what became of all that life? I expect the base is gone by now. I wonder if the grapple I made still twinkles in a broken-down corner of the grain store. Those prisoners are bound to rise up sooner or later. You can't keep your foot on a man's throat so long without facing the consequence of it. And when they do, what then? They'll kill the guards, fall out over the women, scatter in the bush, and their offspring, if they manage to have any, will end up like the tabby that I saw meowing round a cold hearth, flinching at the sight of a stranger. The cranes lurch south each fall. Each year the wilderness reclaims a little more. Each year the taiga riots on another tract of the city. Each month that goes brings closer the time of your departure. And once you've left, I see it going like this. 5 or 10 years after, or maybe sooner if I'm lucky, the horse will throw me in a cold morning, or the stove will catch while I'm sleeping. Or I'll just keel over among the cabbages. I won't have the puff I used to, and it's heavy work chopping those stalks out. Down I'll go, nose in the dirt, and breathe my last. There's not one iota of fear in me about it. I wouldn't have you stay for anything. But I can't think too hard about the world I've bequeathed to you, or the gulf between your childhood and mine, or I start to feel guilty for it. Once I thought I would make this for you to read. I planned to give it to you, copied out in a fair hand with all the spellings checked up against Pa's dictionary. But now I see that the best thing I can leave you is your own blank page. This can stay with the other books I've saved, in the way of a memory stone or one of those Tungus ribbons on a branch at the start of the journey, or the end of one, chalking up a little prayer against annihilation. When you're ready to light out of here, take the Winchester and the fastest pair of horses, and go. Let it be on a bright day in winter for better traveling. And until the wind fills them, I'll be able to look down from the tower on the firehouse at the tracks you leave across the snowfields north, and say to myself, Ping is on her way home.
We hope you've enjoyed Far North, a Macmillan audiobook from Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Text copyright 2009 by Marcel Theroux. Production copyright 2009 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.